Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. The year is 1987, and the snowflakes are perfect, the stars are perfect, but not us. Not us. We are here to ruin ourselves and to break our hearts and to love the wrong people and podcast. The movie? Moonstruck. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Unspooled. I am Amy Nicholson. My co-host, as always, is Paul Scheer, except for today, where Paul is not here. Paul is in Paris. How glamorous. So since he is in the city of love, I'm going to take this opportunity to break his heart and do a movie that we always wanted to do without him. I'm sorry, Paul. But we had the opportunity to have David Sims, the great David Sims from the wonderful podcast Blank Check, here with us on Unspooled. He really wanted to talk about Moonstruck, and I really want to talk to David. So that's what we're going to do today. So when the moon hits my eye like a big pizza pie, that is David Sims joining us on Unspooled. The year is 1987, and Norman Jewison is holding a script that every director has rejected. He can tell the script has been around because when the paper copy finally makes its way to him, it's been dog-eared, it's scribbled on, there's even a big coffee cup stain on it. But Norman has a thing for movies about justice and forgiveness and betrayal, especially when people do bad things because of forces outside of their control. We know this here on Unspooled because we just talked about him last week making the ultimate betrayal movie, Jesus Christ Superstar, where the real star is Carl Anderson's emotional, idealistic, complicated Judas. Both Judas and Jesus keep looking up at the sky to ask God why he's putting them through this tragedy. So Norman is reading this Passover script, and he's seeing some of those ideas in here. It's about a 37-year-old widow named Loretta who cheats on her fiancé Johnny with his brother, Ronnie. Meanwhile, her dad, Cosmo, is cheating on her mother, Rose. And she's in this close-knit Italian family in Brooklyn, so her aunt and her uncle and her grandpa's 5 dogs, they're all getting involved in this. And everybody keeps looking up at the sky to be like, why is the moon making us all so love crazy, so illogical? Can love be practical, or does it have to be this romantic, out-of-control leap of faith? Norman calls up the writer, the playwright John Patrick Shanley, and he calls him into his office and he says, hey, I love this, but what is with your title, The Bride and the Wolf? That sounds like a horror movie, but everybody in here keeps talking about the moon. I want the title to be about that. Moonstruck stars Cher as Loretta, Danny Aiello as her practical fiancé, and Nicolas Cage as his passionate brother. Vincent Gardenia is her dad, Olympia Dukakis is her mom, and there's even a little part in here for the very funny John Mahoney, you know, Frasier's dad, as a college professor who keeps dating his students. None of the actors in this movie think that the movie is going to be a big deal. Nicolas Cage doesn't want to do it. Cher gives it a thumbs down on the set when somebody's like, hey, how do you think this movie's going to do? But Norman Jewison keeps saying, trust me, this is going to win Oscars. And Norman is right. The movie is released on December 18th, 1987, and it makes almost 8 times its money back, and it scores 6 Oscar nominations, and it wins 3 of them. Cher for Best Actress, Olympia for Best Supporting Actress, and Shanley for Best Original Screenplay. That is not bad for a passed-around rejected script. So, what was in the zeitgeist that Christmas of 1987? It is a song about what everybody needs to have to be in love. It's a song about what everybody needs to have in Norman Jewison. It is, as George Michael says, yes, I gotta have faith. Oh, David, is that a banger? You love that song?
I love that song. I do truly love that song. Is that, I guess Freedom 90 is my favorite George Michael song. But, you know, Faith's good.
Is that because of all the supermodels?
No. Didn't David Fincher direct that? I believe that's a Fincher video, right?
Yeah, he did all the good ones. He did Madonna. He did Madonna Express Yourself, where she's like drinking the milk out of the bowl.
And he did Vogue. You know, he did a lot of good ones. No, I like Freedom because it's a bang. No, but Faith, you know, Faith's a lovely song.
You like Freedom and you like Faith. You don't want to choose.
I did not think about how Faith and Moonstruck came out like basically the same day. That is interesting.
Yeah, I love it when you can find these kind of points of connection. I like imagining somebody going out to Moonstruck. Faith is coming on the radio and they're in this vibe of like, I'm just going to plunge in. I'm just going to give my heart over to something. I'm just going to do it this weekend, man.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are watching Moonstruck. And I need to tell you right at the beginning, I do feel a little bit like I am cheating on Paul because I had never seen Moonstruck before and he had never seen Moonstruck before. And we said we were going to wait and watch Moonstruck together. But I like hanging out with you. So we're going to talk about Moonstruck now.
You had never seen Amy. How had you never seen Moonstruck? I'm sorry to do the very annoying. How had you never seen voice?
You know, when something comes out and you're a little too young for it at the time, yes. And then you never get to catch up with it. That's what happened to me and Moonstruck.
Yes, absolutely. We're similar. Yeah.
Are we similar?
I was a little too young for this movie. And when I was a kid and then a young movie fan, I was like, well, that's the movie that Cher won an Oscar for. But isn't that's like a cheesy movie, right? Like, you know, I was very dismissive of Moonstruck on its face. It took me a little while to get to Moonstruck.
What happened when you did?
I could not believe how crazy the movie was. I was like I fell in love with it very, very, very profoundly. And I feel like that's true of a lot of people in my generation. Like, I think Moonstruck had a whole second life recently, or third life, or fourth, whatever life it might be on by now, among my peers. I'm not sure why we all found Moonstruck again, but I do think it went around from cheesy to sort of a affirmed classic. But maybe you hated Moonstruck, so we'll see.
No, I loved it. But I also, when I watched it for the first time, I think I was expecting a more serious movie because I had heard of it as this classic. I didn't know that this was just the daffiest, most over-the-top, gigantic, screaming Nicolas Cage nonsense. I thought it was going to be kind of like a small, passionate love story, a believable little intimate affair between Nicolas Cage and Cher. And so when he enters in this film and he's just screaming like, bread is life.
They say bread is life. And I bake bread, and I sweat, and I should be so happy. Huh, sweetie?
I was like, what is this movie? What is this performance? Oh my God.
Yes, I think it's funny because why don't you immediately realize that a movie starring Cher and Nicolas Cage is maybe going to be a very big, loud, over the top, you know, kind of like, you know, hard on sleeve film. But I too, yeah, I thought this was like a really cheesy 80s Oscar-y romantic dramedy kind of thing. And it is a film that I would say starts out a little gently, but within 15 minutes, basically, it has sort of set its emotional register very high, and it's not really departing from that.
Yeah, right, because it comes in and you get your first glimpse of, like, the dialed-down Cher. You know,
strumming to guitar, right? She's dowdy. She lives in Brooklyn. She, you know, she wants for love, maybe, but she's sort of given up. And you're like, okay, right? We're doing realistic here, and then we exit that pretty fast.
Yeah, it's like Silkwood Cher. We got the Silkwood Cher. She's a real person. Mm-hmm. She's got the graying hair in the middle. You know, I mean, to make Cher look ordinary just feels like a special effect.
I think that's why she won the Oscar. We can talk about it. But this is a rare deglam where she's beautiful throughout, but people still, I think, kind of had the feeling at the time of like, you made Cher dowdy. Like, you know, like you sort of, you fooled me for a minute that she actually is like a dowdy widow. And that was a big deal.
Exactly. And then when it kicks into that register, that giant emotional register, I think what I really liked about it was this movie telling me to buy into a gigantic operatic surge of feeling, right? Like, this is a movie that I think almost exists in the world of opera. You have Nicolas Cage loving opera, taking people to opera, you know, getting that scene that I love in all of these movies where, you know, it just felt like if this was such like a late 80s, early 90s thing where a character goes to see opera for the first time. And then as the music is swelling, they have that one tear and you think like, yes, this person has a deep soul. You know what I'm talking about? Like, that's like Shawshank Redemption, Pretty Woman. Here, it's like opera is your test of are you or are you not a human being or something.
That's like a retrospective series you could do at a revival house, like movies in which opera has some kind of profound emotional effect on the arc of the movie, right? You know, I love nothing more than a scene of someone going to opera and engaging with the most sort of like loud and transcendent and emotional form of art and like emerging shaken or changed, or like Margaret or Birth. All these movies with like a big opera scene where you see someone watching the opera and it's as cool as the opera is itself.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like those scenes work because they work to me almost the way like Moonstruck worked on me. It's like, here you go. You're giving yourself completely over to this other experience with like huge, huge, huge emotions. Maybe you don't even understand why these emotions make sense. Maybe they're loud and they're screaming and you're like, I don't know how we got from point A to point B. I don't know how we got from you're a wolf to I want to have sex with you now. I don't understand how any of this works, but I don't care because you got my buy-in, right? To like these huge screaming feelings.
Absolutely.
Which is hard. I mean, I will say like one thing for me coming into this movie and watching it was like, I grew up in a family that never talks about their emotions. So then watching scenes of this family where everybody is just yelling about exactly how they feel, good or bad. I feel this about you and I feel bad about you and I don't like this. To me, that always feels like watching, I don't know, some sort of gigantic, I'm going to say Keanu Reeves falling down the stairs again, because that's the image I think of whenever I think of like somebody doing the impossible. Keanu Reeves falling down the stairs in John Wick and fighting his way back up again is how I feel when I see people express their emotions openly to their loved ones.
It's not just that people express, you know, that like you have Cage in this film, right, as Ronnie, like, you know, yelling about love and stuff, but that you have Vincent Gardenia being like, I don't like you. You know, to people's face, you know, to like his future son-in-laws, it's like, I don't like you. That Olympia Dukakis is so blunt. You know, everyone is blunt, even if they are depressed or a little kind of out of it. There is a confrontational nature to everything in Moonstruck, which is why things move quickly and you believe it.
Yeah.
This is set over the course of two nights, right? I was trying to keep track this time. It's two or three nights total.
It's two or three nights. I thought this was going to be a month movie because, you know, moon's full every month. I thought it was going to be like the structure of like one full moon to the next full moon. And then it's like a weekend and everything's all set.
Yeah. I think it's maybe just she sees Cage one morning, sleeps with him, goes to the opera with him that night. And the next day, I think, is the end of the movie. I really think it's pretty much like a 36-hour tale. And obviously, there's this motif of like, right, the moon is huge in the sky and it's making everyone crazy. And it's, you know, it's adding a sort of a supernatural layer to things without, you know, in an unspoken way. But yeah, it is weirdly believable despite all that.
Well, I'm glad you say weirdly believable because like Norman Jewison deeply, truly believes in the power of the moon. Here, listen to him talk about it.
The world is affected by the moon. We as individuals are affected by the moon. As a matter of fact, Steve McQueen, I believed, was a warlock because he was affected by the moon. When the moon was full, you couldn't work with Steve McQueen. I mean, he went crazy. He was on a motorbike, went going out into the desert at night and doing strange things. He was not in control. And so I realized, and I did some research, all the poets have written about the moon. The power of being moonstruck. is very real, and people understand that.
Of course. I mean, again, the sincerity. That's the funniest thing is, like, I think of Norman Jewison as this kind of, like, straight-ahead, top-tier Hollywood journeyman, right? Like, he made all kinds of movies. He worked in every genre. He made a lot of stuff that I like, but, like, I don't think of him as, like, an artiste. And clearly I should, because the man's here reading, like, ancient moon poetry and talking about how Steve McQueen is a warlock. Like, he's completely
everything.
Bonkers, which is great, which is how, you know, film directors often should be. And it makes sense, too, because I think he's the kind of director where, like, he made Rollerball, he made Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, he made these movies that are really over the top, and I should give him more credit for the over the topness. I think he made Moonstruck. rather than just, yeah,
he's almost, you're right, one of those directors, and I hate feeling this way because it always makes me feel like a bad critic, but you can see the scope of them better when they die, because he recently died.
Yeah.
And when that happens, when you really get to look back on a body of work from a director like this, you're like, wow, you went after doing everything.
Yeah.
And you admire it so much. I feel this way about Ridley Scott right now, too, where mm-hmm. I, as much as Ridley Scott is venerated in his time of being alive, I feel like it's after he dies that you're going to be like, hold up. You're telling me this guy made, you know, the Gucci movie and also Gladiator 2 and also all of these religious space movies and also.
I agree. I mean, and I think there are themes you can find running through these guys that you don't initially see. But maybe I need to do a deeper dive on the Jewisons I have not seen, because I've seen a fair few, but I've also, there's a ton I haven't. And, like, yeah, maybe there's sort of more maximalism there than I've considered before. Yeah.
And the man was a farmer. Yeah, he was a farmer too.
I know he's Canadian, right? He's a Canadian guy.
Yeah, Canadian farmer, I guess. He said that that's how we got interested in the moon, is he would see his animals react when the moon would get weird, because he had to watch his animals. He's like, oh, my goats are being strange today or something.
God bless.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic, because we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
But yeah, I mean, the way he describes Steve McQueen, it makes me think of just him fully unearthing Nicolas Cage, the Nicolas Cage of the now, the Nicolas Cage of, like, the future. Because, I mean, this is kind of Nicolas's Cage. It's not his first major role. You know, he'd already done Valley Girl. He does.
Right.
In this year, he does Raising Arizona as well.
Right.
But it's kind of the, like, oh, here is what we all think of Nicolas Cage movie.
100. I mean, the combo of this and Raising Arizona at the time must have been crazy. I know Raising Arizona was a smaller movie on release, but that, like, it does kind of feel like, you know, what you've tapped into an electric current with him in these two movies. He's such bizarre casting in a way, although he's one of the only Italians in this movie. Well, that's not true. Danny Aiello and Vincent Gardini are Italian, but Cher's not Italian.
No.
And Olivia Dukakis is an Italian, and
yeah,
Norman Jewison is an Italian. John Patrick Shanley is an Italian. Like, it's practically outrageous, and yet you never care. But Cage must be, what is he, like 10, 15 years younger than Cher? Like, I never really worry about it when I'm watching the movie, but in retrospect, of course, they're, like, in different generations.
Yeah, he's 17 years younger than Cher.
That's crazy.
She's 40 when she makes this, and he's 23. And it never comes up, which is so surprising, because everybody else keeps talking about their age difference. You know, the right. Olivia Dukakis goes on that date with John Mahoney, and she's like, I'm too old for you. And he's like, I'm too old for me. But Cher and Nick never gets brought up. It's just like, all right, here we go.
It doesn't make sense. Like, I guess the even better question is, I'm going to look it up right now. He is, He's 26 years younger than Danny Aiello. Like, they're brothers? Like, this is never explained. You know, who is this Italian mother who seems to be like 1,000 years old? Like, even though Danny Aiello is probably like in his 40s. Like, none of this, it doesn't matter. It's all this kind of like, it's like a mural in an Italian restaurant. Everything's like over the top. Like, there's the just the dying old lady in Palermo, and there's the moon is like, you know, this gigantic thing in the sky, and Nicolas Cage is basically howling at it. Like, all of this is just acceptable as long as you can dial in very quickly to the tone of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically like built into the tone of the movie, right? It's like, do you want to be the practical person who is, you know, worried about your fiance having a greasy stomach and therefore can't eat the fish? Or do you want to just be like, I scream and I am passionate, right? The movie's like making a screaming argument for being a person who just prioritizes passion above all else.
Right. Cage is great. I mean, I love Cage. You're a Cage person, right? Like, we're both very pro-Cage.
I mean, to be a film critic of the modern era means you kind of toggle up and down on Cage, right? Because he'll go through periods of like a bunch of nonsense, but like the bad nonsense, like the boring nonsense. You know, like when he was doing... Oh, God, like Left Behind.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because when he did Left Behind, I thought we were going to get like a real crazy screaming Cage. And he shows up and he's like, I'm going to do this apocalypse movie that in the part that was originated by Kirk Cameron really seriously.
Yeah, no, it's sad when, but that was just sort of a sad era for him, obviously. And then like recently he's been great, but he's kind of been great in this sort of toned down way in stuff like Pig and Dream Scenario. It's not like he's not letting loose a little bit, but you're never going to get what you got here, especially here. Because in Raising Arizona, he's so funny. But here, it's the sort of the quintessential Cage thing of like, why is he screaming? And also, why do I not really mind that he's like, why do I buy that characters are rolling with him rather than just being like, sir, you know, you're yelling in my face. I don't want to deal with you.
Yeah.
Why does that translate to sexual magnetism? Which it does.
Yeah, because it almost starts to operate like on this fairy tale like element, I guess, where, you know, when he's like telling her, you know, come into my bed, come into my lair, come into my thing. And he's got, you know, the wooden hand and he's waving at her face. I thought, oh, right. This is just some weird fairy tale. You know, she already got her makeover done at like the Cinderella Beauty Supplies.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, so he's just playing this like he's the evil prince in an old thing. And then I found out afterwards that that was like super deliberate on Cage's part, that when he came into this movie, his whole idea with Norman Jewison was like, I'm going to perform this character with basically the same accent that Jean Marais gave the Beast in Beauty and the Beast and the old Jean Cocteau one. I want to play a little bit of that accent just so people can hear what Nicolas Cage's role model was for this movie.
Belle. Être ma femme. Non, la bête.
So he shows up, right? He shows up on the set and he's trying to do these lines about bring me the knife, but also adding that gravel onto it. And it was a couple days into the shoot when Norman Jewison was like, these dailies are not working. And Nicolas Cage heard that he was going to get fired if he didn't knock it off.
Okay, so it was actually closer to this. That is... unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
So what we're seeing here is like the more normal version of how this was going to go. More normal than he even wanted.
Because I do feel like that's his reputation is in the 80s is he's obviously a Coppola, but he's got the stage name. So people don't really know that. And it feels like he's trying to prove himself in some way with this, you know, like incredibly outsized approach to every role. But then you kind of just realize there's a little more method to his madness than just being over the top. I think that's what people eventually lock in with about Nicolas Cage. Like, he's making choices. He's not just yelling.
Yeah, that's true. He can calibrate the volume of his choices. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's weird because they tell this version of his early years about like his relationship with being a Coppola that almost make him sound like a tragic fairy tale prince where... You know, he gets like he's in eighth grade, I guess, and he gets like kicked across the country to go live with the Coppolas because his parents are getting a divorce. And, you know, back home growing up, he'd been like popular. He'd been like an A student. Now he's living in this mansion with his movie star family. And he starts getting Fs. He's the misfit. He doesn't fit in. He's a total geek at their school because, you know, they're like up in North California where everybody's rich. And he becomes the outcast of this family in a way where he's like seething with like rage and revenge. And he's like, I'm going to change my name from these people. I'm going to pick a comic book name. I'm going to prove myself to these people by being like, I will be an outsider and I'll be a cooler outsider than all of y'all are.
Right. Right. And it probably helps shape like, yeah, his weird, it is an outsider energy. And in this, obviously, he's basically like this beast in a cave. Like, even though he's a baker in Brooklyn Heights, the vibe is that he's this like kind of, you know, mad animal who's just been like slinging dough for 5 years, going crazy for no particular reason. I mean, apart from that he lost his hand.
Yeah. When she shows up in his basement and you see him, you know, in this like tank top, totally sweaty, covered in glistening goo.
Hair popping out,
flames all behind him. I mean, the movie just immediately, like, it's like somebody put you in the broiler, you know? Which makes me a little sad because, like, it means it's a little harsh on the practical love that Loretta has with her fiance. I am a person who, like, you know, I love getting my boyfriend gum for the airplane so his ears don't pop. You know, I also consider that romantic. And I feel like this movie is like, no. You need the fire guy.
I think it's a good question because but I think the movie does do a good job kind of quietly giving you, Rose's sister and brother-in-law as the kind of settled, happy couple that you check in with. Is it Rita and Raymond or whatever? You know, like,
yeah,
those two
who get turned on by the moon.
Right, the nice moment where they get turned on by the moon, but they are obviously also like the good version of what maybe Danny Aiello is imagining, right? Like a nice, sensible partnership, but there's passion there. There's no passion between Cher and Danny Aiello. Cher is in a deep depression when this movie begins, Loretta, her character. And Johnny basically seems to be occupied with, well, his mother, obviously, like there's the whole stereotype. He is the classic stereotype of this sort of Italian mama's boy. She's sort of an afterthought to him in, you know, he is practical and he's nice and he doesn't seem like a bad guy, but he doesn't really seem too invested either.
No, like the closest he sounds to being a bad guy is when they're watching John Mahoney get dumped by like his latest student that he shouldn't be dating. And right. He does that little snicker about like men who can't control their women.
Right.
A man who can't control his woman is funny.
She was too young for him.
And that line's weird because you're like, he is so controlled by his mom. Like you're saying,
yes.
You know, like, does he not see how he actually functions in the world? Or does he just draw a real sharp difference between like my mama and my fiance?
It's projection, I think, a little bit. I mean, we're jumping to the end, but just when Cage is like, you're still letting her run your life, man. Like, it's such a good line because it is the unspoken tension of Aiello's whole character, right? Is that he really is only proposing to Cher because his mother is dying.
Exactly. And I mean, that whole proposal, it's like, oh, it hit me in a way because she wants this guy to get down on her knees. And, you know, she's saying that she needs this guy to get down on her knees and propose properly because she's worried about the jinx, that she didn't take her last wedding vows seriously enough. They didn't do the whole thing. They didn't do the whole wedding. And she needs him to take it seriously. And to take it seriously, he has to prove it by getting down on her knees. Her dad has to pay for it. She has all these rules. She says it's about the jinx, but it also feels a little bit like she needs the romance. You know, she doesn't maybe even know she needs the romance, but she needs it to be done properly. And the fact that he doesn't think she needs, wants any of that. He doesn't have a ring. He doesn't want to kneel. It's heartbreaking because you really see in that moment a woman who's just decided to settle and she's pretending like it's her idea. I want to settle, you know?
Right. And I think she's like you say, she's in this depression about the loss of her last husband who died. He got hit by a bus, as we keep being told.
How often is that? Like, I'm not in New York that much. Do people get hit by buses a lot?
I'm sure it happens. I feel like it's more like, right, it's like the urban fairy tale of like the tragic death. She got hit by a city bus.
Yeah, there's no way you could say that seriously in a movie. Like, I feel bad for anybody whose like loved ones did die legitimately by getting hit by a bus because like movies have just ruined that.
I'm sure it happens. But so she's, I think, almost resigned to like, well, I can't be in love because then I'll just be sad again if something goes wrong. So it's better for me to, you know, have this sensible arrangement and do everything like you're supposed to, just so, you know, just so nothing can be my fault if something goes wrong. And Ronnie's going to represent the opposite of all of that, but that's what you need the moon to hit your eye like a big pizza pie. You know, that's amore.
Oh, I cannot hear that's amore without thinking about how we're going to someday get that Nick Villalongo movie that's amore about, you know, the Green Book writer, about like his time when he was a lovelorn man who worked at a pizza place.
I am well aware that truly seems like the cursed, Joker-fied version of Moonstruck, right? Like that's what that is. It's like the evil other half. Yes.
Oh, it's true. Oh, you just know Moonstruck is like one of his favorite movies, probably.
100%. He's definitely like, that's the tone we can go for. And it's like, no, it isn't.
Oh, when That's Amore comes out, maybe we should just do like a very special hangout episode where we watch That's Amore, because I've been looking forward to this movie ever since Green Book came out. He wins the Oscar for Green Book. The next day, he's going to make That's Amore. I've been waiting for That's Amore for so long. Didn't they just announce that they have casting for it?
I think Travolta is in it, or was that abandoned? Yep. John Travolta and Katherine Heigl. They shot it. apparently they're being sued by a union saying they failed to pay some wages, so might be in limbo right now, but this movie exists somewhere. It's in the can.
Wow. I believe in supporting unions, but also I need to see That's Amore.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I really relate to the Loretta position here, because I think there's been periods in my life when I was sort of heartbroken in thinking, I don't want to risk getting hurt by genuinely being in a gigantic love, right?
Yeah.
Where I would convince myself, like, you know what I want to do? I just want to be a lady with my cat, and I can have people take me out to dinner every so often, and that'll be fine. Because it felt safer.
Right. She's ensconced in this, like, situation that is protective in that way, because not only is she living with her parents and her grandpa in, you know, this multi-generational Brooklyn home, But like her parents are kind of out of love with each other, you know, like there's not a lot of passion in the house. So she can kind of be like, well, you know, I'll be like them, you know, like it's a reinforcing thing. Like, and that makes sense to me. Like, that's what I was saying about, like, the directness is still there, but they're not, no one's singing opera songs to each other. They're just saying they don't like each other to each other's faces.
It's true. And, you know, I always think that that's like a terrible thing to do, that if your friend is dating somebody you don't like, you just have to suck it up and not be honest with them about their partner maybe being terrible. This movie sort of daringly is like, we don't like him. We don't like him. And there's a love in saying something harsh.
Yeah. But they are also working through their own feelings, right? Like, I think Olympia Dukakis and Vincent Gardini, the parents, they're both like, well, maybe you don't want to end up like me as well. You know, they have that protectiveness that is on the negative side. But yeah, she shouldn't marry Denny Aiello, so they are right.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic, because we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You know, since I was watching this for the first time and I wasn't quite sure where it was going, that moment when Cher takes Danny Aiello to the airport and they're watching the plane fly off, and there's that old Italian woman just putting the curse on the airplane.
You have someone on that plane?
Yeah, my fiance.
I put a curse on that plane. My sister is on that plane. I put a curse on that plane that it's going to explode right on fire and fall into the sea. 50 years ago, she stole a man from me. Sorprese il mio uomo. Today she tells me that she never loved him, that she took him to be strong on me. Oh, she's gone back to Sicily, ritorna in Sicilia. I cursed her that the green Atlantic water should swallow her up.
I don't believe in curses.
Neither do I.
My first thought was, is this a movie about a curse? Like, because you get that shot of the moon right after that. And I thought, did this woman telling this story about two siblings and like fighting over a man, did she curse Cher to fall in love with the brother? Like, is that what this movie is? Is there a curse that can be done or undone?
A little bit. What's this movie had? What's the title that it was? It wasn't called Moonstruck, like you said. Like Norman Jewison came up with the title Moonstruck, right? It had a different name.
Yeah, it was going to be called The Bride and the Wolf. What, you don't think that has a flow?
I mean, I think it looks like, I'm looking at the notes, I mean, it looks, you know, I think I would think what every Hollywood studio would think, which is, this sounds like a you know, period horror movie or whatever. Like, this sounds like a bodice-ripping werewolf movie. But that does kind of, there is a fairy tale element to that title that I guess does fit with this movie, which is sort of a modern fairy tale.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could say that Nicolas Cage is he is kind of a werewolf. I mean, she meets him in the full moon. Everybody's losing their mind. He is a sexual werewolf.
Yes. Their first encounter is in the bakery and he's yelling, I lost my hand. I lost my bride. And she's kind of like, I don't know what to do with you, buddy. And then she gives him meat. She brings him home to his home and gives him a steak.
The bloodiest steak she can.
Right. Like, cause he's like, no, I eat my meat well done. Like, I don't even want to like experience any pleasure anymore. She gives him this gorgeous looking steak. He devours it. And then it's like he's been recharged, right? He's like, his like wolf powers activate. And when he sweeps her off to bed, I'm into it. Like, I would be swept off to bed. But I love how Loretta's just like, okay, all right, fine. I'll go to bed. Oh, who cares? You know, like she's almost resigned to it. Like, I feel like she is only emotionally sort of come to terms with everything when she goes to the opera with him later. Like that's when she really figures it out. The initial passion is a little more just kind of like, fine, someone might as well, like, you know, blow the cobwebs off me.
Yeah, you're right. It's like body first and then brain. And the body part of it, that first love scene, I mean, I love just the rhythm of it, how they first have that screaming fight about, you know, he's the wolf who is willing to cut off his foot. She's the bride who's willing to lose her head. How that fight ends with him flipping the table and then waiting one beat and then smoothing his hair back and then grabbing her, the hair smoothing back. Like, that's the kind of thing I really want to know. Did Norman Jewison direct that? Or is that a Nicolas Cage being like, I'm going to own this sweaty, powerful man?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I don't know.
I have to imagine, like you say, Cage is bringing so many thoughts to the part. But Jewison picked him for a reason. Like, it's not like Nicolas Cage is getting cast because he's the most famous actor in Hollywood. There were more famous actors they could have put here. It's a pretty broad role. There's a lot of guys who could fit in here.
23-year-old Nicolas Cage. Yeah, you could have put Travolta in here now.
Right, yeah. Yes, yeah, 100% Travolta. That's sort of a weird idea. Yeah, Travolta might have, like, that's kind of a downswing period for Travolta. Like, I could see him doing that.
Yeah, because Cage is not, you're right, Cage is not box office at this point. He's about to be box office because of this movie, but he's not box office.
Yeah.
I mean, Jewison said that he cast him because he thought this was the most tormented character he ever had, which is wild when you did Jesus and Judas.
Jesus,
but like, he's right. Like, this is my most tormented character. And so he said he picked Cage because he thought he was the most tormented actor he'd ever met.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And it works because then when they like have sex for the first time, they're not even talking about it in terms of delicate love, which would be kind of absurd for these two people. They're talking about it in terms of like destruction.
Leave nothing left for him to marry. Leave nothing but the skin over my bones.
All right. All right. There will be nothing left.
They both, I think, are so given up on life that, right, they're willing to accept, fine, maybe this is the end for me, essentially. It's funny. Yeah, it's funny because this sounds so unromantic. And it definitely also does not sound like the kind of like PG-rated movie that wins Oscars. That's the other crazy thing about Moonstruck. Like, I just feel like there's, if you do two things differently, this is a film that gets laughed out of the room. This is like a future that's amore, right? Like, you know, who knows? Perhaps Nick Vallelonga will pull it out.
Thank you. I was just about to say that. I appreciate you saying that.
But I imagine that Samore will be the kind of, like, you know, cheesy nonsense that gets laughed all the way to home video or whatever. And then this, that this not just is a hit, this is a hit I can sort of see. It's got movie stars. It's really funny. It's really easy to watch. It's not, like, you know, a taxing movie. But that this is, like, seriously regarded, that this is an award-winning film, feels a little miraculous for something this kind of potentially silly, at least.
Yeah, Olympia Dukakis, she tells the story of going, being in a car somewhere with Norman Jewison. And he's telling her that this will win her an Oscar. And she's like, this man is completely out of his mind. This man has no idea what he's talking about. And also because he has such a low-key directing style. You know, the people who've worked with him, they say that he doesn't tell you very much about what to do in particular, but every note he gives you is almost like a little thread where when you pull on it, you're like, oh. So the one note he gave Olympia Dukakis was, she didn't say which line it was, but she said he told her to throw it away a little bit more, you know, to not be like, I believe this, but to be like, I believe that. And when she did that, she realized that Rose came more into focus, you know, right. The offhandedness of it. But you're right, like Nicolas Cage and Cher in the first 20 minutes of this film are not even seeming to exist in the same universe. Dialed down Cher and like screaming one-handed Nicolas Cage. Those don't seem like they should be in the same movie. So it's wild that they're able to be to force themselves together.
You're absolutely right. And you've also got this script by John Patrick Shanley, who he wrote a ton of Hollywood scripts, but he's a playwright first and foremost. And this script gives everyone a big monologue, like a big meaty monologue to like throw right at the camera. And they're all good. I mean, maybe my favorite little monologue in the movie is Vincent Gardenia talking about pipes, where, you know, you got the three kinds of pipes. And it's really easy to imagine this feeling just kind of like stagey and again, just kind of out of step with reality. And every character feels like someone you might meet, even Cage. Like even Cage just kind of feels like a guy. And the New Yorkiness of it helps because New York is this outsized place. And if you put New York on film, it's going to feel like a fantasy land, or at least it can.
It is, because like that staginess was almost to the point where it kept kicking me out. You know that Vincent Gardenia's fam, that his name is Cosmo. I'm like, okay, it's called Moonstruck. The dad's name is Cosmo. There's a big moon. Every time the moon's out, Cosmo loses his mind. Cosmo was giving his girlfriend a bracelet with stars on it. I'm like, I get it. That when she's in even the bakery for the first time, the flower that's all over the bakery is called Sunburst. I'm like, I get it, John Patrick Shanley. Like, I get your theater guy. All celestial. Of the things. Everybody's howling at the moon. Okay. You know, it really is. If it's not over the limit, it's right at the limit. I don't think you could have one more moon in this movie.
Well, like, have you seen that movie, what's his, you know, Wild Mountain Time, the movie he made a couple years back?
No, but I remember hearing about it. I remember hearing that it was one of the wildest movies ever.
Right. So I don't want to spoil that movie because it has this twist that is so bananas that you truly feel like you have fallen asleep and are having a dream. You're like, this can't actually be what the movie's about. But that's a movie that it's not as successful as Moonstruck, but you kind of have to, Matt, you have to realize it's coming from the same sort of quasi sort of fantasy place that he's writing Moonstruck from.
You
just have to accept. And Joe Versus the Volcano is like that, which is another of his like big swings that doesn't really work.
And he directed that. That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's a great movie. He wrote and directed. I think it's kind of like the check he gets to cash from winning this Oscar for Moonstruck. And then obviously that movie is sort of like a famous flop. And so people turn on him and he goes kind of back to theater. But that movie rocks.
Yeah. And I do think you're right. Even this year, if you wanted to see the inverse Moonstruck, like what if you did Moonstruck, but you changed the dials of it just a little bit? You have John Patrick Shanley's like other movie, which I think is his debut, Five Corners, Five Corners is also about like a very passionate guy who's in love with a girl. But this time the guy's a little bit too passionate in the realm of stalker. And this time the girl's a little bit more suspicious and not into it. That's Jodie Foster in this scene, just as like a background of a setup. John Turturro trying to impress Jodie Foster. He knows she likes the penguins that come at the zoo. He steals the penguins for her, presents her the penguins. And when she's not happy, you're going to hear him club a penguin to death.
Oh, God. Jesus.
Wow, they're unbelievable. Where'd she get him?
From the zoo?
No.
Oh my God. I have never heard of that movie. That is crazy.
I have not seen this whole movie, only random clips of it, but now I want to watch it as like the dark side of the Moonstruck.
That's a really good call. Like it does, it's like I appreciate the tonal swings of a movie of a lot of his movies. Like I think I'm always going to be appreciative of anyone trying something that's just more out there, or especially for a Hollywood movie, more like nakedly emotional, but it can so easily go wrong and get laughed out of the room, as I'm assume that movie kind of was.
Yeah. I mean, and it's weird because it makes you feel like nobody even knows what movie they're in as they're making it. Like how tonally wild it is. I don't know if you feel like this as a critic, but I feel like when I watch a lot of We have to watch a lot of basic garbage, right? Like people think when you're a critic, you just watch good stuff all the time. But we watch nothing but bad stuff. We watch a lot of bad stuff. We watch as much bad stuff as we watch good stuff. And to me, bad can also be defined not just as like bad, but as in dull or no reason for living. Yeah, yeah, boring. So when I see a movie with wild tonal swings, it always wakes me up. It always makes me excited and root for it, even if I think it does it badly, and I can say it does it badly. To do something brave, to kind of take my emotions and pull them around like a pizza dough, it makes me excited.
100%. I don't know. You probably serve on jury. I serve on awards juries sometimes. You know, the kind of thing where you're like handed a stack of discs or whatever. And it's like, okay, watch all this stuff. And like you watch the movies, but like you can always tell 5 or 10 minutes in, like, is this going to be interesting or not? Like you're saying, like, good, that's maybe a separate question, but at least will this be something or not? Like, will this be a real movie? Will this be a weird, you know, swing?
That I'm fascinated in the question of like what is it in the first 5 minutes that tips you off? Because it is true. I mean, one of the great tormented periods of my life was like really early on in my career as a film critic when I was working as a first level Sundance screener. Which is when, you know, Sundance gets like thousands of submissions a year. And they have people even before the programming team who watch everything that was ever submitted that year in a certain category. And they have to watch the whole thing and write an entire summary of it, of everything that happened in the movie. And then like little, and then do more detailed questions on specific elements of it.
Right.
And I was that person.
It's the classic version of like, right. Like, oh, but your job is fun. You watch movies. And it's like, you can really turn on movies after a while if you're doing something like that.
It breaks you. And you know, in that first 5 minutes, and yet Sundance, because they have good moral guidance and compasses, you can't turn it off. You have to watch the whole thing. That's why you have to do the whole plot summary.
Of course. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, but when I tell you, I would spend like, it was like I had to watch maybe 80 films in a month. And at the end of that month every year, I'd be talking to people like I'm in Moonstruck, screaming and thinking that that's a normal way of having conversation because it breaks your soul.
To think that like you only end up seeing like a half dozen really good movies at Sundance.
But Moonstruck, you know, actually, what this movie reminded me of when we got towards the end was Shakespeare, right? Because it's one of those things where it suddenly becomes this very complicated romantic plot and there's all these couples and they're mixing and matching. And then at the end, everybody shows up in one location and they just tie up all of the threads.
You go with it for two reasons. One, it's a movie, so who cares? And this movie already has this energy. But two, because everything in this movie seems to be set in like three blocks of Brooklyn Heights, and you can go check out the neighborhood now, and it's sort of visually unchanged, but it's you know, much, much fancier. I feel like the joke where Gardenia is talking to the gentrifiers about their pipes, like they're the harbingers of like future Brooklyn. But so you kind of believe that everyone's just dropping by anyway. Like, and so everyone just comes in, takes their seat. You know, do you want some oatmeal, Ronnie? Yes, I would love some oatmeal. Like it's a lovely tableau, and then it's just, of course, because you like these characters, you buy every resolution, really. Like, every resolution comes so quickly. Olympia Dukakis is just like, I want you to stop seeing that woman. And all Vincent Gardenia has to do is hit his hand on the table. And you're like, I get it. He just worked through 40 years of this marriage with that whacking his hand. And he knows she's right. And he's going to stop.
But you just can imagine this man sitting there and thinking, I guess I have to give up Mona. There's really not that much to Mona. Right. All she does is think my stories about Piper interesting. We know nothing about Mona. There's nothing. There's no compelling reason to like Mona. We just know that he's worried about death. Death is sleeping. And now he doesn't want to sleep. He doesn't want to die. He doesn't want to do anything. And then he just hits the table.
I mean, we know that Mona powders her cleavage like so well at the Met. There's like a 10-second unbroken shot of her doing it. You kind of love it. But yes, no, I like the Olympia Dukakis, Rose's repeated line of why do men chase women, right? And all these men keep coming up, trying to come up with other answers for her. John Mahoney and Danny Aiello keep, you know, and it's because they fear death, right? Like that's when Danny Aiello says that and she's like, that's it. Thank you for answering my question. That's all I need to know. You're absolutely right. It's just they're afraid of dying, so they keep going after the younger woman or the newer thing. That's all it is.
I mean, you're a happily married man. You have an adorable daughter.
True.
But if you had to project, why do you think men chase women?
I this movie is like is like on my Ten Commandments. It's because we're afraid of dying. There's no other. It's definitely not because we're chasing the hole made by Adam's rib or whatever nonsense Daniela then tries to roll out. No, it's not that. I think Dukakis, you know, she's like the sort of the moral center of the movie, right? She's the only one who actually doesn't stray. Not that I think the movie is, you know, some hectoring film about, you know, monogamy or anything like that, but like she's just a little more like emotionally grounded, and she just is, you know, she's exiting kind of like a down period in her life, clearly. And, you know, sort of the walk with Mahoney kind of wakes her up. I love when she, so, you know, in the movie, like, you know, she goes on this sort of pseudo date with John Mahoney by mistake, right? Where he's basically clearly like, come home with me. Like, why not? And she, you know, she doesn't want to do it. But when he walks her to her house and he sees her house, he's like, you live in this? You live in like a mansion. And she's like, it's a home. And he's like, I live in a one bedroom apartment. And it's, I do feel like he is waking her up a little bit to like, you have this like wonderful family and this like, you know, long life here, like, you know, these sort of generational life here, like, that's not nothing.
You're right. I can imagine as a New Yorker, there's really this undercurrent to it of like the real estate fantasy. You know, at the beginning, she's like, well, if you marry Dan Aiello, I'm going to sell the apartment. Like, I guess if I was a New Yorker and owned that apartment, I'd be like, you will never marry Dan Aiello because you have to keep that apartment.
I'm screaming at her, like, do not sell your apartment on like Hicks and Cranberry or wherever this apartment is. Like, no, never, ever sell that home. It's worth millions.
I don't know much about Pipe, but I can't tell if Cosmo is like robbing people with his copper pipe or not.
No, Cosmo's right. Cosmo's right.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Copper is the only way to go. Right. It's at Cranberry and Willow Streets, which is, of course, the most romantic sounding streets. Like, but that's the actual intersection of the Moonstruck House, if anyone ever wants to go see it.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that. That is probably real and still there.
Oh, it's still there. It's the same old house. The exterior, obviously. You know.
Wow. Are there still like family bakeries around there?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, there's still Fascotti Pizzeria, which is one of my favorite, like low-key favorite CP pizzerias in the city. It's this like quaint part of Brooklyn where they are, and you see her on the promenade, you know, when she's sort of walking in her heels in the morning and all that, and the promenade is so pretty. But it's gotten so touristy over there, you know, because it's so nice. You can see the city, and so people come down now, and you know, they walk over the bridge and all that. So it's a little different. It's truly sleepy at this time in the 80s. Still, I think
I heard that in Bensonhurst they named a boulevard after Vincent Gardenia. That they have like Vincent Gardenia Boulevard.
Absolutely, because he's from there. He's from 16th Avenue. I just saw it on his Wikipedia. I mean, if no, you know. Even though, I mean, I appreciate and love that this movie is made by every kind of, you know, Brooklyn ethnic, right? Like I said, like it's got Irish, it's got Jews, it's got Greeks, it's got Armenian, you know, it's got all, it's got every kind of sort of person involved in it. But Vincent Gardenia is more than enough, I guess, to give it like true Brooklyn Italian cred. Like that guy is for real.
It's true. I heard that even the grandpa, you know, who's just glaring at people all the time and stuff. Did you know that the grandpa, he is so old, Fyodor Chiaplin, when he plays this movie, that he had actually been friends back in the day with all of the opera actual greats. Like he knew Puccini, right. He knew Tchaikovsky, he got lunch with ones with Stravinsky. He was a person there as like a walking ambassador of opera culture in this opera movie.
That is so cool. He is so old in this movie. And I think he's actually, like numbers wise, I think he's like 80 or something. He's not actually that old. So he's Russian. He's not Italian either, right? He's from Moscow. Huh.
Wow. I guess they also have their own culture of passion. Is it just like my suburban families that don't have a lot of passion? What happened? I really wish I would have grown up in a more vocal family.
I don't want to be here to, you know, to make disparaging, proclamations about WASPs or whatever, but certainly it's just like, it's, you know, you're just kind of allowed to be Italian if you are on screen, if you are Greek, Jewish, you know, like, you know, if you are any of these other kind of like, you know, New York immigrant communities, I guess it's still kind of permitted to this day, like, which is a sort of weird thing in a time when we're, you know, more focused on like, oh, no, people should be playing to their own like backgrounds and experiences and all that. And it's like, well, but if you're going to do Italian, like a lot of people can do Italian.
Yeah. Like, I'd be curious to know if like Italian people consider Cher honorarily Italian, because she would always say at this time, like, this was nothing like her family. She's from California. Her right. family is Armenian. That she, if anything, she kind of modeled her experience in being in a loud family like this on, you know, when she was married to Sonny Bono, how he came from a family kind of like this.
Right.
But then I also read that Cher's own mom was married 8 times and that 3 of those marriages were to her dad. So that her mom just kept divorcing her dad and remarrying her dad, divorcing her dad and remarrying her dad, which to me makes me feel like maybe Cher understands it a little bit.
A little bit more than you'd think. Yeah, damn. Look, this is quite a Wikipedia page. Jeez.
Yeah. And I mean, this is such an interesting period for Cher, you know, because she was really Norman Jewison's choice for this role, you know, and for kind of an unexpected reason. Like, he didn't want her in this because she had just won or been nominated for the Oscar for Silkwood, the movie she made about like cancer.
Which she's really good in. Right.
She's really good in it. You know, at this point, like, her music career has been dialed down for 10 years. She and Sonny had spent the 70s doing the variety show. That's actually how Norman had gotten aware of her, was like watching her variety show, because he thought when she did the Sonny and Cher show, she actually had a great sense of comic timing, which I think he would know and respect that more than anybody else, because he used to direct the Judy Garland show. So I think he understood what it takes to be a woman hosting a variety show on television. But so she's trying to get more into acting since music has not been working out for her. And really just doing it by showing up at the Oscars and wearing like outlandish outfits. You know, the year before this, like the 1986 Oscars, that's the one where she shows up in that like famous showgirl dress with the feather headdress. And she's up there on stage in front of Hollywood, basically making a joke about how nobody takes her really that seriously.
As you can see, I did receive my Academy booklet on how to dress like a serious actress. Nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role are Donna Michi in Cocoon.
Donna Michi's going to win that Oscar.
I had to play that clip a little long because I love Cocoon. I just want to give Cocoon a shout out.
Good. that's right. That's the year she had been, you know, quasi snubbed because she was in Mask, and she won the Cannes Best Actress Award for Mask, the Peter Bogdanovich movie.
Yeah.
And the Oscars had snubbed her. So she was maybe, you know, enacting a slight revenge by being like, well, I'm just going to show up and look sort of awesome and outrageous and kind of make fun of you guys.
Yeah, right. I'm going to show up like wearing, I don't know, I guess it's like wearing pajamas to a funeral of somebody you don't like or something. Like,
right. Pajamas plus headdress. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It almost seems like she had a moment in her life where she said, you know what, I'm going to invest 4 years of my life into making sure I get an Oscar. And once I do that, then I'm going to drop the mic and be like, okay, I'm fine now. I did it. I got my Oscar. Like, she went after it the way you would campaign for high school class president or something.
100%. The same year as this, she's in Witches of Eastwick, which is a, she's great in that too. It's a, you know, this is the better role, but she, I feel like she picks out really interesting people to work with, right? You know, she does a Robert Altman movie. She works with Mike Nichols. She does Bogdanovich. She does George Miller there. And you're, you know, like, she's not stupid about this stuff. And the Oscars are stupid, especially back then, with the sort of de-glam thing. Because I feel like the Silkwood Oscar nom, that's similar. It's like, oh, look at her. She can play a regular person. Like, congratulations to Cher. Like, we, no one would have ever thought. And that's ludicrous, obviously. Like, that's not the only good thing about Cher's film acting. But I think it does impress people all the more that, like, the superstar can kind of, like, strip it down a little bit.
I think you're right. And what's kind of interesting about even just Cher as a superstar is, I think what makes her rare in the world of celebrity is she's the person who kind of wills herself to be famous without even necessarily thinking she has, like, a certain skill. You know, a lot of people are like, I'm a singer. I'm really going to be a singer. I love singing. And once I am a singer, then I will move into being an actress. But that's kind of not her arc. She was just thinking from the time she was young, I need to be famous. Whatever I need to do to figure out how to be famous, I don't care. She's very agnostic about whether she's famous for being a singer or a dancer or an actor. It's just, how is she going to will herself to be that? And it's kind of, I guess, instead of seeing them as a contradiction, the way people act like about Keanu Reeves wanting to be in a band or something, she sees them as working together, because it's when she does Moonstruck that she then gets her singing career back on track. You know, she has her first top 10 hit basically when Moonstruck is in theaters. But then also, I think she comes out of this Oscar cycle with maybe the tiniest, for like at least a millisecond, bit of bad blood.
I mean, I do think Cher has this like vengeful side that I sort of, you know, shout out to her. Like, she sort of outlived everybody, and she was famous over many decades, and you give her credit. But yeah, she doesn't seem like the absolute, like, breeziest person in the world. yeah.
But yeah, I'm on your side about that too, though, where there are some people where you just want to let them be them. It, when you see her come into this movie being de-glammed and then taking that time halfway through the film to get her hair done, put a dress on, put her lipstick on, and become Cher, you're just happy for her. You're just happy to see Cher become Cher. And I love that sequence where she's, you know, sitting there by a gigantic roaring fireplace, listening to smoking hot jazz. And it's like the one moment in the film where she is finally alone. You know, there's not her family's not home. Nobody's around. Nobody's bugging her. Nobody's making her feel like she's not the right kind of 37-year-old woman because she's not married with a kid. Nobody's making her feel bad about herself. And she gets this like scorching jazz oasis to be good to herself and become the Cher that we know that she is.
Right, right.
It's like almost she has to fall in love with herself, I think, to fall in love.
Yeah, that's the thing. She has to wake up all by herself, as well as, you know, like Nicolas Cage is, she's in love with him, but he's also like roaring her out of complacency. And then her emotional turmoil, you know, you see the ripple effects. Like it shakes her parents out of their complacency. That's great. It reminds this other nice old couple what they've got. That's great. You know, like it's saves Danny Aiello's mother's life, right? is the implication.
You're right. It's like she's been sleepwalking, you know, like she's been sleepwalking and she gets to wake up.
Yeah.
So then let me ask you this though, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
When you're watching a movie and you're kind of wrestling with that idea of like, I want to give myself over to the big emotions here, how do you, in the moment, grapple with, reconcile, whatever word you would use for that, when you look at something like Nicolas Cage, sweaty tank top baker, suddenly also has like an empty seat for the opera in a box, and he also owns a tux, and he also even has the little white scarf to go with it?
Well, again, you're going to have to just buy that Nicolas Cage is not the age that he is. But he loves the opera. We know this. We're in his home. What does he have? He has pictures of, you know, Puccini on the wall and stuff, right? Like, he's, if there's one thing he's passionate about, it's the opera. And so I guess it's, again, it's like, it's almost like his bat suit that he needs to put back on.
is and like, you know, meeting Loretta is what does that for him. You know, is going back to the opera in his tux. I personally do not own a tux. Yeah, if I had to go to the opera tomorrow, I would not be showing up in a tux. I do know where the Met is, though. Loretta doesn't seem to know where it is. You would think she might know where it is. She is a native New Yorker. It's not that crazy to say, like, you know, I'll meet you at Lincoln Center, but whatever. It's a great line when she says, where's the Met?
That is a great line. And nobody at the hairdresser shop seems to know where the Met is either.
I guess it's sort of a joke about like the provincialism of Brooklyn at the time, which I think is was more true, especially back then, of like, yeah, we don't really leave here. You know, you would call Manhattan, quote unquote, the city, right? And you would rarely go to the city.
No, it's true. I mean, I think that is one of the little throwaway lines I love, you know, where's the Met? And the other one that I really like is in that Shakespearean climax when it's Rita, right? Yeah, when Rita, her aunt, they're all silent. Everybody's finally quiet for really one of the only times in the entire movie. They're just quiet. They're waiting for Johnny to show up so that everybody can be broken up with and rearranged and love can be set right. And when the doorbell rings and Rita goes and gets it and she says his name like this.
Johnny Camerari.
That just makes me laugh so much. That it's makes so me funny. So happy.
It's so funny.
Well, I am so happy we did this movie, Dave, even though I feel like I broke Paul's heart. Even though Nicolas Cage doesn't seem happy he did this movie. He gave interviews right afterwards saying, I was so upset with myself for being in a sentimental romantic comedy that I immediately had to do Vampire's Kiss where I ate a cockroach. And of course, I have to play the sound of him eating a cockroach because how often do we get to hear that? But in honor of Nicolas Cage and the sacrifice that he has made for our enjoyment, let's throw this to the other movie that he did this year that we've been talking about a bit, a movie that I deeply love. Nicolas Cage, Holly Hunter, Coen Brothers, and Raising Arizona. If you have not heard this episode yet, oh, it is so fun talking Cage. So, David, I mean, Norman Jewison said when he made Moonstruck and when he took it to the Oscars, it was his way of making a statement against mindless action films. He was sick of mindless action films. He wanted to promote movies where people talk to each other. But I think right now you are doing some good work on Blank Check, promoting people who make just really, really good, maybe mindless, sometimes mindless, not always mindless, wonderful action films. What are you up to right now?
So I am the host of Blank Check, which is a podcast where we talk about movies going through directors' filmographies. We're doing John McTiernan right now. We just had Paul on with Jason for Last Action Hero, Jason Mantzoukas. So
their shortest episode ever, I heard.
Very long episode if you want to enjoy that. But yeah, we've been doing John McTiernan, of course, this sort of great boom bust action director of the 80s and 90s. And then we'll have many other things going forward. Amy, you must return, obviously. You've been on multiple times.
I know. I was only on right at the very, very beginning. And then
No. You can't. You forget that you did Village of the Damned, the John Carpenter movie.
That's right.
How can you forget?
I still have a Village of the Damned back set that I use on Zoom sometime. Me and all the haunted children.
There you go. Perfect. So we're going to have you back soon. Actually, I have some ideas for that. But Blank Check. That's my other podcast that I host. Please check it out. And I do obviously do film criticism over at The Atlantic.
Dave, I look forward to hanging out with you in New York. You're right. The last time that I did the podcast with you live, I was itchy because right at the end of it, I was going to go run and go to Coney Island.
That's right. That's right. Well, we come back to New York anytime, obviously, and we got to hang. Yes, we have to have some sort of food adventure along with you appearing on my show or whatever.
Yeah. Take me out for like the biggest meatballs they have in the city.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Well, thank you again for joining us, man. Take me out for a meatball as big as the moon.
Yeah, we should go to some Red Sauce Italian joint. Yeah, we should go to like one of these places for Moonstruck. We'll go to Michael's or whatever.
Beautiful.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me, Amy.
Our show could not be done without our team, and a huge thank you goes to them each and every week, produced and edited by Cody Fisher and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media. And you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram. And you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section. T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled. And you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
What an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like.
Next, don't give it to you.
How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Biosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it?
Next, don't give it to you.
Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S.
Give up.
Order now at Acura.com.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.